Blog Talk Radio.
Rich Rossi Live.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We're excited today to have two champions that have really fought on behalf of a lot of you independent filmmakers out there. Michael Donaldson and Lisa Califf have fought for some films that others talked about would have a tough time legally, and they've really helped artists to tell their stories without too many burdens and to tell them the way they want to tell it. And we're going to talk about some of the cases they've dealt with and fair use and some other things. So we'll be back in about 20 seconds here with entertainment lawyers Michael Donaldson and Lisa Califf here on Richard Rossi Live. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and Michael and Lisa, are you there?
We are.
Okay, great. Okay, we got you on the line. First of all, thank you, both of you, not only for coming on the show, but for what you've done for so many filmmakers out there.
Hey, Kai, this is actually Chris, the office manager. Michael and Lisa just stepped away for 1 second, and they'll be right with you. Sorry for the delay.
Okay. Is Lisa here with us?
Hi,
okay.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Hi, I'm sorry. How are you?
Good. Is this Lisa?
Yes, it is. How are you?
Hi, Lisa. We'll catch a breath for a moment. I'm doing well. In the intro, I was talking about how you and Michael, you two have done so much for filmmakers out there. So thanks for, on behalf of the filmmakers listening, for all you've done to stand up in the trenches for us.
Well,
our pleasure.
Very kind, very kind.
Well, I'm just curious for both of you, Michael and Lisa, how I know law is such a diverse profession. Everything's from, you know, civil to criminal law. How did you both end up being advocates for artists?
Well, it's for me, and just doing what comes naturally. I come from a family of well, on one side, bankers, but on the other side, writers, actors, that kind of thing. So, you know, standing up for underdogs of all kinds has sort of been my life.
Now, for me, I grew up in Los Angeles, and so most people are involved in the arts in one way or the other, and I wasn't talented in the arts. I couldn't act or draw or write, and I was pretty good in school. My dad was a lawyer, and so I think putting that together of, oh, I can be an entertainment lawyer, and I can be around artists and help artists fulfill their goals and dreams and make products with them was very appealing to me, that I could be part of it and fill this hole that some artists have of doing the legal side of things and the business side. So that's what really drew me to the profession.
How early, for filmmakers out there, how early do you come into the process? I know you probably start with some films, but I know in some of the more controversial ones, like, I was reading about the Yoko Ono suing the filmmaker of Expelled, and did you come into that one once a lawsuit was there, or were you on hand before, earlier on in that project?
Yeah, we're not litigators. We were brought into that to do the clearance work. They had been to talk to some other lawyers who said, "Oh, you can't do that," and somehow heard about us, and we worked with them to make it very, very safe. And if you followed that case, the judge had no problem saying that our opinion was right, but that we were dead right. She didn't even have a slim chance of victory. So that was a very satisfying case, because our intent with those filmmakers and with all filmmakers is to make their activities so carefully within the fair use doctrine that they really don't have to worry about getting sued. And if they do, they don't have to worry about losing.
Wow, that was amazing. I was, you know, cheering you on when I heard about that because, I mean, talk about a well-known personality, which is a little intimidating to a filmmaker, that's for sure.
Yeah, that was actually a fun one to work on. You know, when we came into the office, you know, we want to use a Beatles song and we want to use it here in this film that we're certain his camp will not agree with our philosophy and what our film's about, but we want to use the song and believe it's fair use. And then really working with them so that it was legally very sound, and then, you know, just making sure that it was very clear to the audience why we were using that song, you know, that it wasn't just, oh, we want to use a Beatles song because everyone will know it and it's a catchy tune. It was really, it was important to the storyline, and it was something that the filmmaker talked about right before, you're taking a page out of John Lennon's songbook, and he used just as much as was necessary or reasonably appropriate to demonstrate that point, and that was it. You know, there was no, don't use another 10 seconds of the song. It was very clear. And then to have the validation and affirmation from the court that we were right, it was like, yes, you know, it was pretty cool.
Well, I'm a big fan of you guys because a couple of these, you know, the armchair experts, you know, spoke the opposite, that there's no way, a Beatles song, no way. And also with the Disneyland one, that was amazing for our listeners. Many are probably aware of that case, but the film that was shot in, I think, both Disneyland and Disney World secretly. I bought a copy myself and enjoyed the film Escape from Tomorrow, but so many people said, no way is Disney going to let this pass. That was really another interesting case, wasn't it?
It really was. Every single paper wrote about that case when it was in, wrote about the film when it was in Sundance, and they all said it's too bad it can't be released. And again, we worked with the filmmaker. There was a couple little tweaks, but it wasn't major work that needed to be done in order to have it insurable at a very reasonable price, by the way. It was really, that was very, very satisfying. Longest opinion letter I ever wrote because it had, you know, people in the background, copyright issues, trademark issues, and of course that wonderful issue of just making an entire feature film right under the nose of Disney at the park. You know, it was an amazing accomplishment. Very, very cleverly done. Shot in black and white because when you retake a scene, you can't be sure you're going to get the same color teacup when you're doing it without permission. So the whole thing was so cleverly set up and so carefully done. It was just a real joy to work on that.
Yeah, it was amazing. Amazing
the
courage.
If you bought the DVD, there's a DVD extra where I talk about our process in getting that.
Yeah, I saw you on there, Michael. I saw you on there. You did a great job, and I was amazed at your courage and the courage of the actors, the filmmakers, the actors that had to go along with this as well, and they all had to kind of buy into a ballsy move, basically, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know, I read some articles that seem to almost oversimplify it and say, well, the reason they got away with it is Disney decided they were so mad about this film, they just didn't want to further publicize it. I mean, is that true, or is that kind of an oversimplification, do you think, of why they didn't respond?
Well, you'd have to ask them. What I said to the press is that I thought Disney wasn't coming after us because they have really good lawyers, and they know that this was a classic parody. They promote that park as the happiest place on the world, and anybody that spent a couple days there with a pack of kids knows that there are times when that's not true. The parody nature of the film was rock solid. So good lawyers don't make a big public stink when they're going to lose. That's not a that's a silly waste of time and resources. And it's interesting because filmmakers often come in and they'll say, "Oh well, you know, this clip is owned by Paramount," or you know, and I always tell them that I would much rather have clips used pursuant to fair use owned by a major studio than have it be, you know, somebody's grandson who doesn't really understand the business, goes to parties, and his friends who also don't understand the business say, "Oh, you're going to be a millionaire, sue those people." Well, it doesn't turn out to be true, and those kind of people are harder to talk with because we're not using the same language. We don't come, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to have a really rational dialogue with somebody who's been ratcheted up by all his friends and is just sure that he's right and he'll make a lot of money if he files a lawsuit.
That makes a lot of sense. I really enjoyed your book, Clearance and Copyright, and I do remember that you laid out real clear in the book. You guys lay out the different, you know, things about fair use. And I remember parody. There was a really big section on parody and how to determine if something's a parody. So that really helps me understand better the whole Disney project because it fit that. And by the way, your book has been updated. The latest edition, the fourth edition, has, I think, some new information in it, doesn't it?
New information, and what's really cool is if you're reading about a film, we provide a URL where the film will just come right up on your phone and you can watch the clip while you're reading about it.
Yeah, so all of you out there listening, this is, you know, I'm obviously not a lawyer, and I was able to understand this book and get the concepts of this book. I've tried to read other legal books and, you know, struggled a lot more. But this book, I understood it. I read it, and it was, for a legal book, I thought easy to read for me. And it's Clearance and Copyright.
I guess fair use. That was certainly the goal in going in and writing this book. I mean, from the first edition, which was published 25 years ago or so, to this one, we always wanted to maintain that user-friendly feel to it and really have the whoever picks up the book to really understand and get a good conceptual understanding of these issues that can be daunting, you know, but if you break it down to what the fundamentals are, they're actually not as complicated as people may think. So I'm glad that came across and you had that experience with it.
So, yeah, fair use. I really did have a great experience with it. The whole issue of fair use gets thrown around a lot. You know, just I guess for those out there that are wondering when it does apply to them, I mean, what misunderstandings do you run into with filmmakers in terms of fair use? I imagine on both sides you get people that think, "Oh, I could never do that," and they can, and maybe people that say, "Oh, I'm fine, I'm covered under fair use," and they're not. Maybe Lisa and Michael, you could speak to, you know, I'm sure you have a million anecdotes of just people coming to you with a misunderstanding of it.
Yeah, we do. We have quite a few. You know, the worst one is when somebody feels that they really understand fair use. They say, "You know, I read your book. I totally get fair use. Here's my film. Write an opinion letter." And we always like our clients to be educated. And usually clients who read the book or who watch some of the films we worked on do get a very good understanding of fair use. But there's always things. I don't think there's been a film where someone's given me the film and I haven't had suggestions or changes if they really wanted to fair use certain clips where it wasn't well enough contextualized or it was too long or something like that. So usually it really is in our office a collaborative process with the filmmaker where we go back and forth and have a dialogue about what things can be used under fair use and how can we make it safer, because our goal isn't to win in court. Our goal is to get an E&O insurance provider comfortable enough to insure the film and a distributor comfortable enough to distribute it. And nobody wants litigation whether you're going to win at the end of the day or not. So we have to take a little more conservative approach. And I think that's well outlined in the book exactly how we do that. But that is one of the common misconceptions. Someone just thinks they come in here and we just write an opinion letter, you know, but it really it's much more of a process than that.
Mm. Yeah, basically, the way you tell if something's fair use in a documentary is, are you using the material to illustrate a point you're already making? You only use what's reasonably appropriate. And number three, is the connection clear between the material you're using and the point you're making? If you get a yes to all three of those, you have a very rock-solid fair use. And if your answer's a little mushy, you're still probably fair use, but it isn't rock-solid. And we always let clients know what they might do to make their fair use even more bulletproof.
And then on the flip side of that, I think some people come in after they've licensed a whole lot of footage, or I don't know if it's worse than that or just equally frustrating, is when people have already reached out to the license holders and are negotiating licenses, and then they come to us and they say, well, can we fair use this? And just because someone's negotiated a license doesn't mean they can't fair use it, but it can create a breach of contract issue or just a higher risk because you're on that licensor's or copyright holder's radar. You know, instead of saying, well, where are you? Are you going to license this? Are you using it in your film? And it's just an extra added layer of work that our office and the client has to do if they start reaching out to copyright holders and negotiating licenses and getting screeners and making contractual commitments to license things. It's often better to do the fair use review first and then figure out what's not fair usable, and then go out and license those materials.
Hmm. So it's best to have you guys engaged much earlier than.
Yeah.
It's always
an easier process if we can come on early. You know, if we're just doing clearance work, we often come on at a rough cut stage. If we're doing all of the production legal, it provides us with an opportunity, or even if the client just comes in early before they start cutting the film together, it provides us with an opportunity to really give the filmmaker tips and guidance as to how to utilize fair use as much as they can. And so it makes for an easier process the whole way through, and someone doesn't have a cut that they're married to, and we're telling them to make cuts to it and changes, and that doesn't always go over so well. So it's much easier if they come in early, and we're really shaping the film from the beginning so that they can really utilize fair use.
Saves the filmmaker money to come in early.
Yeah, I think the rough cut stage, that's such an excellent point you're making too, because once it gets more solidified, artists feel like, oh, you're cutting off my arm. I'm just so married to the way this is right now.
People do tend to fall in love with what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, like Stephen King said, a writer has to kill his own babies. And how about on the fair use fiction side? I know most of us think about documentary and nonfiction. Is it still the same principles, or does it change much when you get involved with a fiction film using fair use?
Well, if it's a scripted film that is a true story, a biopic, if it's a true story, the rules would be the same. And I've been saying that for years, and recently, and only recently, the courts have upheld and confirmed that view, which was really, I sighed a big point of relief. when you start moving beyond that, if films are based on something true but tell a fictionalized story around it, the part that is true can use fair use pretty much like a documentary. Then you get into films that are totally fictional, but they're shot in natural surroundings. And as long as you don't focus on all those artwork and posters and stuff in the background, it's our position that that falls within fair use. You don't begin to get in trouble until it's a scripted film shot on a set where you're dressing the set, you're making the choices. Then the case is, or at least one major case, has gone the other way. But and so that gives everybody pause. I'm not sure that case was correctly decided, but it was decided. It's the ruling law, and we all have to be a little cautious when it comes to photos and pictures that are part of set dressing.
Yeah, a lot of that, those set dressing issues, a lot of the set dressing issues really really kind of are make or break with regard to fair use on whether or not the filmmaker had creative choices. So if you're filming in a bowling alley and you're not placing the stuff up on the wall, there's a much better fair use argument that you captured that incidentally and you're not focusing on it. But if you go into a bowling alley and you start moving things around and you place that poster that you want and that kind of thing, then you really have to license it. And that's pretty, it's very clear from the case law that you would have to license that.
We have some questions coming in from filmmakers by email. And also, if you want to call in a question, well, you can email questions out there if you're listening to richardrossilive@gmail.com or call the number on your screen if you're listening live. And this link, by the way, it will be good in perpetuity for people to share. And the number to call in is 347-637-2379. The best website for you guys, for people that will need you in the future, is it the michaelcdonaldson.com?
No.
That's
I don't like that website. Not because of the name of it. It's not an updated website. But our website is donaldsoncalif.com. So it's donaldsoncalif as in Frank.com. And that has, you know, all sorts of information about us, about the attorneys we have here in the office, contact information, and other stuff about our firm.
Okay, great. DonaldsonCalif.com. And if you could just hold Michael and Lisa, just stand by for just a second. We're going to go pick off some questions here from people listening, okay? We'll be back in like a few seconds.
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
We have we went to the email here. A YouTube question. Someone, James in Atlanta, said a couple years ago, he writes about a Tom Cruise video. I think it was from the Church of Scientology he was involved with. It was up, then taken down under protest of the church, then YouTube put it back up because of fair use, is what they read. They were curious how fair use applies to a site like YouTube. Oh, did we lose Michael and Lisa? Okay, I might have to dial back out. If you're listening, we've been talking about fair use with Michael Donaldson and Lisa Calif. Their book is Clearance and Copyright.
Donaldson Calif, it's Chris Lee.
Oh, hi, Chris. We're live on the air. We got disconnected with Michael and Lisa.
Absolutely. Hold on one moment. They're expecting the call.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the book is Clearance and Copyright, and you can get it Amazon or wherever books are sold. And the website for Michael and Lisa is DonaldsonCalif.com.
Hello?
Donaldson. Oh, hi. Is this Lisa, Michael?
Yeah, sorry, guys. We had some technical difficulties over here. Apologize.
Oh, that's okay. We just lost
we're
a couple
back.
Seconds. Yeah, we were getting a question in about YouTube, fair use in YouTube. A question had come in. They gave an example of a Tom Cruise controversial Scientology video that was up on YouTube, then dropped I guess, out of maybe someone protesting from Scientology, and then YouTube put it back up and said, we're fine because of fair use. One of the questions that just came in was YouTube and fair use. So if you have any comment on that, either of you.
Well, the rules are pretty much the same. The U.S. copyright law has not really caught up with all the technological changes. Some other countries have. Certainly Canada has some special exceptions for what you can post on YouTube, but we don't have that yet.
But is the question what you're people posting things on YouTube or taking content from YouTube to put in your film?
I think it was posting things on YouTube. They were curious about it because they've seen cases where something was pulled down because someone protested it. They gave an example of a Tom Cruise a video leak
right.
from his church, but then YouTube pulled it off, but then I guess researched it legally, said, you know what, we can put this back up, and then they put it back up, and it's gotten a lot of hits.
Yeah, so if you're putting something up on YouTube, you do have to own it. I mean, that is the law in the United States, that you have to own the material you put up. So if you're putting up other people's videos or other people's songs, you know, there certainly is a practice that is pretty acceptable, especially if you're not making money off of it and usually you're just promoting somebody else's work anyways. But legally, that is copyright infringement. You know, if you're taking somebody else's work and making a copy, the test is not whether or not you're making money off of it. It's just making that illegal or unauthorized copy. That's the copyright infringement. So if somebody was upset about your copying, you know, if you used a song in the background and put up a video on YouTube of your kid dancing, which was a case, then that music publisher, that record label could sue for copyright infringement, and they could be successful. You know, unless it's clearly fair use, they could be successful.
Hmm.
So it is important. It's typically low risk, but it is, you know, it's good for people to understand that it is a risk, and that copyright infringement really happens when you make the copy that's unauthorized.
Hmm. Interesting. I think we have time maybe for one more question. We have one from Mike in New York. And as a filmmaker asking, is the primary focus when he decides to work with lawyers such as yourself to obtain the E&O insurance to protect him if he does get sued? Is that the goal, the focus or the goal in a situation?
That's the ultimate goal. But we achieve that by having as our goal on each and every unlicensed item, whether it's a film clip, a piece of a song, a photograph, a piece of artwork, on each item, we want it to be as solid a case for fair use as is creatively workable. That's the goal. And working with a filmmaker so that they understand what the creative choices are. And then the result, once you get all that done, is, yes, insurance is less expensive and easily available.
Mm. Well, I tell you, the time has flown by, and I can't thank you, Michael and Lisa, enough for, I know you're a busy firm and cases coming in every day, and, I heard from filmmakers last night that were just excited about hearing from you, because these are the kind of things they worry about and think about, so... Again, the website for you guys is donaldsoncaliff.com, and the right. book, I know you have several books, I believe, but Clearance and Copyright's the one that I read. From both of you, would you, any final words to the artists out there from both of you before they cut us off here?
I'll let Michael do the final words. He has a very eloquent way of doing it.
Enjoy what we do so much and so blessed with so many really quality films coming in as can be attested by the consistent Oscar nominations. This year we had 21 films in Sundance. We have 23 in South by Southwest. And the reason a lot of these films get attention is because they're able to access more material to illustrate their story that they're telling. And the opportunities, when you really understand your rights, are so much broader than most people believe. You've mentioned a couple of examples that sort of blew a lot of people's minds. You know, not ours. We're here to help artists tell their story their way.
Hmm. Well, that really sums up what you guys do, helping artists tell their stories their way. Well, you've been a blessing to so many artists, and I can't thank you enough for doing that, because we've enjoyed the films that you guys have represented. I've enjoyed so many of the titles I know that you have both represented. And so thank you for that, and thank you for being here today. And I'm eternally grateful for people like you, because the right brain artist types sometimes just are lacking the ability to go to that left brain legal mind and think about these kind of things. So thank you again, a thousandfold.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for having us. It's been fun talking.
Okay, blessings to you, Lisa and Michael, and have a good rest of your evening.
All right, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And thank you to all of you for listening. Wow, this was such an interesting half hour. And for you filmmakers listening, Thursday is another tremendous resource for you all. I'm having on my dear friend, filmmaker Mark Freiberger. Mark and I went to Italy together. I directed a film, and Mark directed a film that was in a festival in Milan there, and we went to Italy together. And Mark has just written a book, How to Raise Money for Your First Film. And Mark covers all the conventional fundraising strategies as well as some of the newer things on the horizon, and how people are getting money for films through things like Kickstarter, Indiegogo. And so he's going to address that kind of crowdfunding issue, and also, you know, how to integrate that strategy with some of the more conventional strategies. So about 90% of the people here in Los Angeles where I live are want to make a movie or have a screenplay or an idea for a movie, and they say, how do I get the money? Well, I've made a couple of low-budget films, and that's a question a lot of my artist friends come to me. It's like, how did you get some money to make the films you've made? So we're going to answer that in great detail Thursday, 11 a.m. here at Richard Rossi Live. Mark Freiberger, I think it might be his first interview with this brand new book that he's just releasing, How to Raise Money for Your First Film. So join us Thursday. God bless each and every one of you, and thank you again for tuning in to Richard Rossi Live.